We have breaking news in the United States war with Iran. The U.S. Navy has just announced it's going to restart guiding ships through the Strait of Hormuz. It's unclear whether that's a physical escort or whether it's now just going to be telling them where to go. There's some indication that they could actually be escorting vehicles through there. It says the United States is renewed this Project Freedom, an earlier U.S. initiative to guide ships through the vital shipping chain corridor. The official said the Navy plans to help about a dozen vessels, including super tankers and container ships, to cross through the waterways. Now, all this comes in the context of we're allegedly in the final stages of a negotiated settlement. President Trump said over the weekend we're 95% of the way there. And now then all of a sudden we're trying to restart Project Freedom, which is according to the Iranian side. We're not even close to an agreement. So we're going to try to figure out what all this means. And we are very lucky today to have with us Colonel Douglas McGregor back on the show, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to the Secretary of Defense, and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, as always, welcome back to the show. But man, how about that to hit you right upside the head when you start?
Well, you know, we got to figure out what this is, what it really is versus what we may think it is. Let me be clear. Are we simply issuing instructions over the radio to ships that have already paid the toll and are passing out of the strait with the permission of the Iranians? I mean, it strikes me that that could easily be the case for this Greek supertanker. We don't know that. I mean, they have 2 million barrels of crude. That's fine. They say they're going to be escorted by the United States Navy, but it really says guided as it crossed the waterway off the Omani coast. Well, that means the ship is already out of the strait. So we're not escorting anybody through the strait. We're just radioing instructions to vessels that have already passed through the strait. Now, is that what we're talking about? If it is, then it's not much of an achievement. I mean, you're essentially saying, oh, okay, here, we'll help guide you once you're out of the strait, and thank you so much for your cooperation. Maybe that's one side of it. On the other hand, if we're telling the world that we are now going to sail into the strait and signal directly to various vessels who comes next and then steaming through with them behind us, which is what escort usually means, well, then I guess we're restarting the war because I'm sure the Iranians will sink the ships. So what is it? Do you have any idea, Dan? I don't know which is accurate.
Oh, it's just breaking just before we came on the air. And that one little snippet we showed you there from the Wall Street Journal is all that's been published so far. This completely comes out of nowhere. No one in the administration's even been talking about this for a week or so. And then to have just drop it on us, everybody, on Tuesday morning, is kind of a curious thing. But, you know, it seems to me, Doug, that this is just more evidence of this incredibly disjointed, seemingly haphazard way we're approaching this whole war, the negotiated settlement, et cetera. President Trump said, I think it was on either Sunday or Monday, hey, we are 95% of the way complete on a deal. Like everything is almost done. Just a little bit of stuff is left. Then all of a sudden, he says, by the way, last night, all the nuclear dust must immediately be given to us. No dust, no money released, you know, and then now this here, Project Freedom is going to be restarted here. Meanwhile, we're trying to get some negotiations. I'll show you what both Secretary of State Rubio as well as the Iranian side said here in just a second. But I mean, how do you keep track of all this stuff? Because it seems like it's just literally somebody throwing darts on the wall and seeing what happens.
Well, I think I'm beginning to develop an acute case of schizophrenia, which is helpful because it's the only way to follow Donald Trump. You know, he twists himself like a pretzel and then jumps into a box, closes it behind him, and then magically tells you he solved the problem and it's peace breaking out all over. I think a lot of people have figured out that what this man does brilliantly, let's give him credit, is manipulate the markets. That's what he does. As for accomplishing anything with Iran at this point, I don't see any evidence for that at all.
And, you know, I said that we'll take a look at what the markets are, what Secretary Rubio has had to say. But there was another thing that's, you know, seems to really throw a monkey wrench into this. While we're trying to get to some kind of an agreed settlement. And again, over the weekend through yesterday, there's all kinds of reports on social media and leaked through Axios, et cetera, that most things have been agreed to. A lot has been agreed to, but we've got to work on a couple of deals. We're working on that, et cetera. And then last night, all of a sudden, we get this note that the United States had attacked apparently some speedboats from Iranian speedboats, missile launching capacities, facilities, and several other things here, which seem to be a complete violation of the ceasefire agreement. And one has to wonder, what was the purpose of that? Do you have any idea what was intended in our strike last night?
Well, the official line from CENTCOM was that we struck back in self-defense. In other words, that these small boats that had the capacity to lay mines, I guess, were attacking us. And so we were defending ourselves, and we struck back with obviously far more missile power than we were subjected to initially. You know, I'm sure that if you and I are confused about these things, I'll wager a lot of money that the people on board ship right now sitting outside the Strait of Hormuz are equally confused, because I don't think they know precisely what it is they're being told to do.
And let's take a look at the Iranian reaction, because they have said, listen, the tensions are going to rise because they threaten to retaliate against U.S. strikes. In fact, some reporting out this morning says that they did. I cannot independently verify this yet, but this is by the Hormuz letter, was claiming that Iran, or the IRGC, claimed that they shot down another MQ-9 drone fired at an F-35 and an RQ-4 drone in response, and then said that more is going to come later. What is official is from one of the diplomatic sources in Iran, from their embassy in India. They said, listen, perpetration of these aggressive actions, concurrent with the ongoing diplomatic process mediated by Pakistan, once again exposes the dishonesty and unreliability of the ruling establishment of the United States, the peoples of the region, and the international community. It further demonstrates that principled approach for the Iranian nation across three arenas of the field, public sphere, and diplomacy is grounded in profound mistrust of the American regime. And then you see at the bottom there, it says, without any doubt, the Islamic Republic will leave no act of aggression unanswered and will show not the slightest hesitation in defending its sovereignty. So one of the things I've seen in otherwise this morning was that the Iranian side said, we don't just have these knee-jerk immediate reactions. We think things through. But according to this official statement, they're going to do something in retaliation to last night. But I want to center in on that center part there, though, Doug, because they're saying, listen, how can we have any negotiated deal, to your point just a second ago, when we don't have any kind of trust at all? I mean, even if you hate Iran, we still have to have some kind of trust so that whatever terms we want to agree to, they have some confidence that we'll actually abide by them. Otherwise, how do we have any kind of an agreement even that we want?
Well, I think the Iranians have reached that conclusion. First of all, I think they know that ultimately Mr. Netanyahu has veto power over everything. In other words, even if their intermediaries talking to the Pakistanis were to sign up for something, and we might initially regard it as acceptable, they know that Netanyahu can intervene quickly and say, nope, that's unacceptable, and we're back to square one. Netanyahu right now and his government really has no incentive to cooperate with us to forge any kind of useful peace agreement in the Persian Gulf. They just don't. As far as they're concerned, it is in their interest to keep us engaged in destroying Iran. And until Iran is destroyed, this war is not going to end. I think the Iranians have figured that out. The second part of this is a little more complex. If you look at what went on last night and the responses that we elicited from the Iranians this morning, I think Donald Trump is caught up in what he thinks are useful tactics designed to induce compliance with what he wants Iran to do. I know that sounds ridiculous, but if you go back to his book, The Art of the Deal, and you page through it, there are lots of discussions of tactics that range from coddling to bullying your opponent on the other side of the table. And you've always got to go back to Roy Cohn's rules, which is you must remain on the attack at all times. I think if you look at that broader picture, what he's written in his book, The Art of the Deal, and his Roy Cohn, you know, rules for life, it begins to make sense if you're Donald Trump. Now, for the rest of us, it makes no sense at all. This is not a real estate deal. This is life and death now for essentially, potentially, hundreds of millions of people all over the globe. We're staring at the potential for famine and a whole range of really catastrophic developments in the global economy. So, you know, whatever he thinks he's doing, it isn't working. He's actually making matters much worse. He's making it much harder to come to any sort of agreement. And if that turns out to be the case, he's really defenseless. He has nothing left in his quiver, so to say. There's nothing new that he can do that is going to change this militarily. He may not know that yet, but I think that's where we are.
Well, it appears that he may not be aware of it, but he still thinks, okay, well, let's try the diplomatic path and see if I can just, maybe with these crazy actions here, I can induce them to doing what Secretary of State Rubio is trying to get. And according to him last night on his plane, he said, we have the outlines of a preliminary deal on the table.
Well, look, I think our position is well stated. The president had a very important, I think, historic call just a couple days ago with a number of leaders from the region. I think there's strong alignment and agreement on what a preliminary draft should look like. I think that, like anything with something like this, it's going to take a couple days to settle on, even down to the disagreements over a word, sentence. So we'll have to work through that. If there's going to be a deal, we're going to have to work through that. But this is, it's either going to be a good deal or there isn't going to be one.
So, I mean, yeah, we either have an outline, but if it's not a good one, there's not going to be one. Because now, to my ear, it sounds to me like he's saying, here are President Trump's preferences. You either meet all of this or there's not going to be a deal. And then the question is, or what? Because President Trump on a Truth Social, I think it was just yesterday, said, listen, I want all that nuclear dust immediately. And he never said or what, but he seems to think that he can just get it. And that's not even on the table for the Iranian side, as we'll see in just a second. That's like in a phase two. And yet Trump's talking about he wants that prior to phase one. How's that going to work, Doug?
Well, Donald Trump is incoherent. Let's be frank. There is no coherent framework that he sticks to. And he tends to mix various elements of an agreement at different points in time, which explains your comment about the nuclear dust. The interesting thing is that Rubio sounds, well, ultimately Rubio is more articulate. What he says sounds more plausible, but at the end, it's the same outcome. Either we're going to get what we want or there will be no deal. It's effectively what he's saying. And no deal is better than a bad deal, or so he thinks. What is a bad deal? Anything that leaves Iran intact. And what are the principal stumbling blocks? It's obviously this enriched uranium business that moves back into the center of the discussion routinely. And in addition to that, that Iran cannot retain control of the Strait of Hormuz. Well, those are two insoluble problems from the standpoint of Iran. Iran sees both of those as inextricably intertwined with their national sovereignty and independence. So I think we can say with some certainty there's not going to be a deal. Forget it. The other thing is we aren't talking directly to the Iranians. It seems that people don't really get that, you know, because Donald Trump conveys the impression, well, we're close to a deal and they're much more professional now, as though we have suddenly become professional. I can't conceive of anything less professional than the goons that we've sent over there to negotiate. So at this stage of the game, I think we just have to wait until this war breaks into the open. And I think we're getting closer. And with this event of last night, it seems almost certain that we're going to go back to a hot war.
And let me just kind of underscore that from the Iranian side. We always show what both sides are saying on here, and then we see what's real on the ground. Here, we just saw Rubio say that, well, we have the broad outlines of an agreement. Well, here's what the Iranian side is saying with Foreign Ministry statement spokesman Baghai.
The focus of the negotiations is on ending the war. At this stage, we are not discussing the details of the nuclear issue. Threats, pressures, portrayals, and publishing caricatures are part of the political maneuvering on that side of the world. We pursue our work in the field of action. We see the realities, regardless of the perceptions and imagery of the other side. It is true that we have concluded a large part of the topics under discussion. However, no one can claim that this means an agreement is imminent.
And he went on to say in that same interview, almost exactly what you suggested right there. He said, listen, all we've been doing is sending intermediaries back and forth through Pakistan. But he said, until we are close to an actual deal, we're not even going to meet in person because there's no point in it. So until we see both delegations going to Pakistan, then we might say, okay, now something might actually be possible here. But until that point, Iran's saying we're not even close, even though President Trump is.
No, I think that's true. And, you know, if we could just divert a little bit away from what's really happening in the discussions to what I think are really far more serious issues that the president and his colleagues in Washington don't seem to understand or be facing. You know, in April, U.S. inflation increased from up to 3.8% from 3.2%. Right now, this war is leading to inflation projections for the second quarter of roughly 6%. Now, if that's true, and I think it probably is, that means our interest rates should be at about 7%. But that would be catastrophic for us. And so they're being artificially suppressed and held at about 3.75%. So what are we really doing right now? We're sort of watching the edifice of our security architecture, our diplomatic strategy, all sort of sink into the abyss. Now, why is this happening? When we first started this war, we ended up taking 13 million barrels of oil off the market every day. If we restart the war against Iran, that is, we go back in and start hammering Iran from the air and from the sea with all the missiles and bombs that we can accumulate, Iran says it will counterattack and remove an estimated 25 million barrels out of the global market. Now, we have 374 million barrels in our strategic petroleum reserve. 25 million barrels are held in Oklahoma, I think in Cushing. The rest tend to be largely in Texas and Louisiana along the borders. Right now, we know that President Trump has sold 17.8 million barrels this last week from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve at a price below market rates. That means lower oil prices below $110 per barrel. Now, what's this done? Well, this has helped him to manipulate the oil market in a way that insulates U.S. users of fuel from the real impact of the Iran war. This manipulation at its current rate will drain our strategic petroleum reserve in roughly 60 days. So let's do the math. That means by the end of July, we're staring at an empty strategic petroleum reserve. Now then let's turn to China. China is 86% self-sufficient in oil, but it still has a 14% shortfall. Those shortfalls are being made up by various countries, including Saudi Arabia, mostly Russia and some others. So they're not in a dangerous position whatsoever. They've stockpiled oil. They have the largest petroleum reserve in the world, 1.3 billion barrels in above ground storage. That means they could all be extracted. Now let's go back and understand what else is happening, because we tend to see the Ukraine war and what's happening there as completely separate and distinct from what's going on in the Persian Gulf. And that's not really true. In 2022, at the start of the Ukraine war, 3 million barrels were taken off the global economy per day. This drove the oil price at that point initially up to $120 per barrel. Today, right now, the United Kingdom and our European allies are providing drone components and targeting data to the Ukrainians so that they can attack refineries and other oil infrastructure inside Russia. This has been successful insofar as it has reduced the numbers of millions of barrels per day by 13 million from the global supply. At this rate, what are the long-term implications? We're going to watch the global economy shrink by an estimated 36%. Now, just for Just for referential purposes, the Great Depression reduced the world economy by 20%. However, the effects of the Great Depression were mitigated by much lower debt to GDP ratios that currently prevail in the United States and Europe. What happens if we lose, say, an estimated 30% of global productivity? Well, this is effectively a global depression. We're going to be part of that. So to talk in a cavalier fashion about, well, we'll go down and bomb these people into the Stone Age. We'll bomb them until they agree to go along with us. And you're staring at 6% inflation projections for the second quarter. I think we're bordering on insanity. This is irresponsible on a scale that I cannot imagine. I don't know of any similar action that any president, king, or emperor in the last 300 years has taken that would compare to the irresponsible approach that we've taken to the Gulf and also towards Russia in the Ukraine war.
Well, which is really saying something, and nobody knows history better than you do. This is literally the first time, I think, since I have known you that you were not able to grab some historical example to say it was kind of like this, which is really scary because that means that we're navigating something that's never been traversed before, and we have literally the worst people possible at the top to do the navigating. We'll see where that leads.
I don't know if they're the worst, but they're certainly not the right ones. And, you know, I urge people in the audience, you want to understand this, you've got to go to people like Luke Grohman, to Gundlach, Ray Dalio, and Peter Schiff. All of these people are essentially depicting what I just said in even more profound terms. I'm just trying to understand the oil and gas markets. Now, when you start talking about everything else that we're missing, sulfuric acid, without sulfuric acid, yeah, you can't refine anything. That puts the copper industry in a terrible position. You can't refine uranium. I mean, we just go down the list. It's disastrous. And that's just a snapshot. That's the tip of the proverbial iceberg. And at the same time, you know, we're riding here in the United States on something akin to the Titanic that is already partially underwater. That's our economy and the financial system. That's the point. What can we do to get out of this? And frankly, we're not going to escape all the consequences at this point. But if he were to shut down everything right now and simply say, that's it, you know, we cannot go on because this has humanitarian consequences for the entire world. As president of the United States, I am obligated to suspend further combat operations. We're still talking about months before the oil redistribution recovers. And even then, you're looking about 2 or 3 years to rebuild a lot of this infrastructure that's being destroyed. So what we're really talking about, if he goes back to war the way he did before with our forces, is Armageddon. And the idea that the man with his finger on the button for Armageddon is not really Trump, but Bibi Netanyahu, is even more disturbing.
It is. And you know, one of the first ways that we can try to mitigate against some of these economic catastrophe that you're talking about that is in progress until we check that and open it back up is to get the Strait of Hormuz back open up to something close to what it was prior to this war. And that means these dueling blockades that we have, ours against Iran and Iran's with all of the rest of the GCC countries, those things have to be open. Now, Iran is ready to say, The traffic can return to normal as long as they're paying our fees. But Marco Rubio was asked about that last night.
What's happening there is unlawful, it's illegal, it's unsustainable for the world, it's unacceptable. I don't know of any country in the world that does. The Russians are not in favor of a tolling system. The Chinese are not in favor of a tolling system. I mean, there's no country in the world that's in favor of a tolling system except the regime in Iran. So that's not acceptable. That cannot happen. The straits need to be open, unimpeded, without tolls, and obviously that needs to happen immediately as soon as anything's
agreed. Yeah, obviously that needs to happen, but we tried, Doug, for 40-some-odd days to force them to open that strait up, and we utterly failed, and so then we went to this ceasefire that we had to because we realized it wasn't going to work, and so Rubio can say that all day long, but what is going to have to happen, Doug, to get these two blockades opened up? What's the reality?
Well, the reality is not exactly as depicted by Secretary of State Rubio. Secretary of State Rubio is conveying the impression that somehow or another, miraculously, our views align with the rest of the world, or the rest of the world's views align with us on the subject of the Persian Gulf, and specifically this issue of tolls. Right now, if you look at the polling data that's available, but all you have to do is listen to the leaders and their public statements, the world holds us responsible for shutting down the Gulf. That needs to be understood. They are not blaming Iran for shutting down the Gulf. Everyone understands that it makes sense for Iran strategically to do what it has done. That doesn't mean they like it. Are they opposed to it? Of course, but they blame us for it. This is very important. In India, we've gone from, you know, reasonably popular down to hated beyond belief. And that's not just true in India. The attitude is spreading very rapidly across Asia, particularly in Japan and Korea, in China, all over Asia. This is catastrophic for us. You know, I don't know what to say. You know, the funny thing is, I came across this statement by Donald Trump, who made this observation back before he was even elected the first time. And he said, if our presidents would have just gone to the beach and enjoyed the sun and the beach, we would have been much better off in the Middle East. Now stop and think about that. In other words, his attitude was, when he was the ultimately became the nominee of the Republican Party in 2016, it was, well, if we had done nothing, Dan, just gone to the beach and enjoyed the ocean and the sun, we'd be much better off in the Middle East today. Well, you know, somebody needs to read that to him again, because that's even more true now than it was then. The damage we did to ourselves and to the world at that point, I wouldn't say it was marginal, but it was recoverable. What we've done to ourselves now in the Persian Gulf, when it was absolutely not necessary to do so, is beyond evaluation. It is global in its impact.
Now, interestingly enough, he left open this, Secretary Rubio, in that last soundbite, he left open that, well, if we don't get the deal we want, implying we would go back in. Now, a lot of people in President Trump's ear have been shouting for that. Of course, you know, the normal ones like Jack Keane, General Kellogg, Mike Pompeo, Mark Levin, Lindsey Graham. These guys have been saying this for a long time. Well, there's a new person here in the last couple of days that's adding to that. And it's your old pal, General Petraeus, is saying, hey, you know what? We might just have to go back and finish this the hard way.
Other core issues that we have with Iran, such as its nuclear stockpile of almost 1,000 pounds of 60% enriched uranium, that's just one level below weapons grade, the right to enrich in the future, their support to proxies in the region that are pretty murderous, the Hamas, Hezbollah, Shia militia in Iraq, Houthis in Yemen, and then the missile programs and the rest of this. And I think it's a pretty limited amount of these other concerns that may ever get addressed, but clearly there has to be an agreement to get the strait reopened and to restore freedom of navigation without, there might be some arrangement where perhaps there is some modest fee charged that might go in part to Iran, Oman, who knows, and navigation aids or something like this. But that, I think, is the imperative at this moment in time. And I'm not sure that Iran is going to be willing to do that. Right now, they are insistent that they are given control of the strait and that they are able to charge tolls for it. That's just, I think, unacceptable. And it may be that we have to go back to war to show them that we're pretty serious about this.
Come on. I just... Help me understand even the logic in his own mind here. You failed to do that when it was full on war for 40 some odd days. Now that we've gotten restocked with the same ammunition against the same targets, and we're going to expect a different outcome. What is in his mind when he said we may have to go back to war to show them we're serious?
Well, let's reflect for a minute on what David Petraeus thinks is war. To him, war at this point is simply high-altitude bombing and missile strikes from the sea, from the air. That's all. He doesn't seem to understand what he's actually describing. This is not Iraq. This is not Afghanistan. This is Iran. This is a huge country. It has a real civilization. It's a real nation state. It's not a collection of Arab tribes that were herded together as a result of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. This is not in any way, shape, or form artificial. This is real. He's talking about going to war. If you're going to go to war with Iran, you're going to have to mobilize the United States. This is not a minor affair. People forget that Germany in 1942 had roughly 80 million people. We're talking about an Iranian population of 93 million right now. And they obviously have access to extraordinarily advanced technology in a whole range of areas, as well as to overhead satellite arrays in space. And he's talking in a cavalier way about, well, I guess we'll just have to go to war to make our point. Now, I'm sure the people that have him on their payroll at KKR, all of whom are ardent Zionists and part of the larger Israeli-Jewish financial network, will reward him for his statements. But this is extremely irresponsible. The United States has no interest whatsoever that would justify this kind of action. None. And at the same time, we ought to step back and keep in mind that we have this state called North Korea, which everyone insists is ruled by a madman. I have never subscribed to that. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's quite sober-minded, actually. But a lot of people think, oh, well, he's just a dangerous maniac. And he has nuclear weapons. What are we doing about it? Nothing. Why are we doing nothing? Because he has nuclear weapons. So what is David Petraeus and everybody else on the neocon globalist Israeli agenda part of? They're part of a group of people that are convincing billions of people all over the world to invest heavily in nuclear weapons to ensure that we and our Israeli friends never try to interrupt or disrupt or invade them.
And of course, that's not going to lead anywhere. That's not going to get the strait open. It's not going to help the problem here. It's just going to exacerbate it. And the Iranian side has said, yeah, if you do that, we're going to do all these other things. And you're not going to destroy our mountains. You're not going to destroy our missile bases. So I just can't even understand, even within the twisted logic of the, you know, the neocons and all that kind of stuff, they have to be able to see, and this is more a question than a statement, they have to be able to see, don't they, that it physically can't work, so that their desired objective, regardless of what it is, can't be accomplished. And if they try, it's going to harm us, right? I mean, don't they see that?
My real question is, if Donald Trump 10 years ago could tell the New York Times, if our presidents had only just gone to the beach and enjoyed the ocean and the sun, we'd have been better off in the Middle East. What happened? What's wrong with Donald Trump? That was an eminently reasonable and balanced statement by Donald Trump, because the first law in foreign policy and diplomacy is do no harm. In other words, if you can avoid going in somewhere with military power, it's in your interest to do so. We have no reason to do any of the things that Petraeus argued for. So what are we doing? What is Donald Trump doing? Where is this man? What has happened to him? I mean, that's the $60,000 question that I ask myself almost every day.
Well, and I think only historians are going to be able to give us the answer to that. We're not going to get it in the near term, and we're just going to have to hope that this one doesn't blow up in our faces for all the reasons you just mentioned. Now, unfortunately, that's not the only major issue that we have on the table right now that potentially could lead us into a catastrophic war. We're going to pivot now over back to the Russia-Ukraine war, because there's some things that are going on with that recently that also have some alarm bells that also could escalate into ways that harm our own interest if we don't get that one off the table and go to the beach on that one too, I guess. Now, it turns out David Petraeus also talked about that war and gave this sage advice.
I've actually said for almost a year now that I could envision a situation in which, if there's sufficient support for the Ukrainians, and this 90 billion euros from the European Commission is very, very helpful, it probably takes care of them for another year and a half. And if they can continue to increase the production of drones and pilots and units that can use them and all the rest of that, and start going deeper in Russia and inflicting such casualties on Russia that it's maybe the same as what they're recruiting on a monthly basis. You know, they've now taken almost 1.4 million killed and wounded. That's more than we sustained in all of World War II. So, and all of a sudden, last month, the Ukrainians took back more territory than the Russians actually took from them. Certainly next year at some point, I think Putin's going to look in the mirror, especially if the lifting of sanctions on their oil sales and the price of oil are reimposed. And his National Welfare Fund runs out of money because it's being diverted to the military-industrial complex. If all that happens, I think you could see a point where Russia needs a cessation of hostilities as much as does Ukraine.
So according to Brother Petraeus there, man, that old Vlad, he's in real trouble here. And pretty soon he's going to start wobbling. The wheels are going to come off. And I don't know, the Ukraine side is going to roll up to Moscow. What do you make of that?
Well, his numbers for Russian losses are fantastic and utterly mythical and fictional. But, you know, he's reading from a set of talking points that were created by the CIA and the MI6 and the Mossad. Nothing new in any of that. It's all nonsense. He also, remember, this is the man that told us, I think it was 2023, maybe he said it in 2024. He said so many things so often that turned out to be catastrophically wrong, but he kept insisting, well, now the Ukrainians have finally mastered combined arms operations. And I'm confident with the new infusion of equipment and the NATO training that they are going to be able to break through Russian defenses. This was the Sorovikin strategic defense line that had been set up and bring this war to a close. That made no sense at all. In fact, it just killed hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians pointlessly. And the great minds that direct NATO forces, primarily but not exclusively American, to a lesser extent British, simply sacrificed more and more lives on the altar of Ukrainian freedom, ostensibly, but in reality, NATO expansion. It's hard to listen to this stuff and take it seriously. I think he's completely missed something that you understand, I understand, and I think the Russians are increasingly concluding as well. Strikes alone do not win wars. Unless you have a force on the ground that can exploit the effects of the strikes, that can move in and establish control on the ground, you are not going to bring any war to a successful conclusion. It can't be done. Now, the Russians, you would think, understood this a long time ago. But for various reasons, President Putin has decided to exercise restraint. He's wanted to hold back forces. First of all, he doesn't want to govern all of Ukraine. People that say, well, he's weak, that's why he won't take Ukraine, it's nonsense. He doesn't want to govern Ukraine. He just doesn't want Ukraine to be a bulwark for future attacks by NATO against his country. That's it. So if you can make Ukraine a truly neutral state on the Austrian model, I think the Russians would be more than happy to sign on and go home. But the point is that we've utterly refused to do that. We don't want that because that would be an admission of absolute, total, and complete defeat of the West. Right now, that means us and our NATO allies. But if you don't have a force that can go into the ground, more strikes won't help. That's what the Russians are learning and have been learning for many, many months. And I think now we need to look at the map and look at the concentrations of Russian forces that are not very obvious to many people in the West right now. There are over 100,000 troops poised in Belorussia to strike south towards Kiev. That includes somewhere between 20 and 30,000 North Korean troops. You have another 250,000 that are operating in the northern portion of eastern Ukraine, and roughly 250,000 to 300,000 operating in the south, moving towards Zaporizhia. They could cross that river whenever they want to and ultimately go down and seize Odessa. If Odessa falls into Russian hands, it's game over. Absolutely no question about it, because then Ukraine has no outlet to the sea. The rest of it, in terms of Kiev, falls de facto into Russian hands. Now, people are saying, oh, well, they won't do that. They'll never do that. I think those things are very very likely to happen, unless, and this is important, you see the governments in Berlin, London, and Paris change. And right now, Germany looks like it could end up with a chancellor who is not a globalist, who is not a neoconservative nominee, somebody who is actually a German nationalist and is committed to the interests and the welfare of the German people, and that is Elise Weidel. She could conceivably become chancellor. You can't govern that country right now without the AfD. They have roughly 30% and growing support in the German electorate. If that happens, the AfD has made it abundantly clear they're going to go back to buying cheap energy from Russia. They've also made it clear that they will expel us, the United States Armed Forces, from German soil, as they should. We should have gotten out of that place 30 years ago. We've had these discussions many times. We've overstayed our welcome all over the world. And we've done it at a point in time where technology dictates the withdrawal. Because if you put anything far forward, as we are currently postured, then you risk losing all of it in the opening minutes of any crisis or conflict to precision-guided missiles, whether they're tactical ballistic missiles, theater ballistic missiles, unmanned systems of various types, whatever they are, you can't survive it. So it makes sense for that to happen. And the new chancellor of Germany is absolutely not going to put Germany on a total war footing to finance the creation of some new World War II style army, which is a waste of money for the Germans. The bottom line is, if that happens, then I think Putin's patience will be rewarded. If that doesn't happen, if that's postponed further, then I think the pressure to march over the Dnieper River, take Odessa, march into Kiev, put an end to this horrible regime is absolutely irresistible. And the biggest mistake we could make is to be drawn into this. The good news is that President Trump at least expresses the desire to get out of it. The problem is we continue to provide the critical data from our satellites and from our intelligence community and from our platforms that enable the Ukrainians to do the things that they're doing to Russian infrastructure, not the least of which are the civilian targets that have been struck and resulted in needless civilian deaths. So that's a problem. We should pull the plug on that. That should have happened a long time ago. That should have happened when Trump was first inaugurated. He didn't do it. And at the same time, you know, this means that the Russians, who would otherwise, I think, help us and assist us with Iran, have absolutely no incentive to do so whatsoever. And by the way, you now have this retired General Flynn. This was the brilliant architect of our withdrawal from Afghanistan that got so much attention, he and his friend McKenzie. And Flynn is leading a delegation of people in Taiwan from the military-industrial congressional complex who are there to look at what additional American investments can be made in Taiwan military capabilities. Catastrophe, disaster. This and the immediate aftermath of Trump's visit, humiliating visit to Beijing, that eventually convinced Trump, fortunately, the one positive thing in my judgment that came out of the trip to Beijing, that the notion of going to war on behalf of Taiwan is lunacy. And he explained it. He explained that Taiwan's 100 miles from Taiwan. China's 100 miles from Taiwan. And we're, 6,000-7,000 miles away. We can't sustain it. We can't support it. It has no future. It won't work. And in the midst of all of this, here is this man who should have been removed for what happened in Afghanistan. And now he's leading this delegation. What a catastrophe. And all of this contradicts Trump. And we're back to where this all started. You started with this. So what is Trump saying? What's real? What's not? What is meaningful? What's not? And nobody really knows because it's so incoherent. It changes so rapidly. It goes back to my point on schizophrenia. Only a diagnosed schizophrenic could make sense out of what Donald Trump says from day to day. That's a disaster for a superpower. It's a disaster for any nation state. But for us in particular, for the reasons that we covered earlier that have to do with the economy, our economy, the global economy, it's catastrophic. All of this crap needs to stop.
It certainly does it before it's too late. But you talk about schizophrenia and who knows what it's doing. It's one bad thing if it's happening in the Persian Gulf because of the implications it has for the global economy. But it's another level of problem when it's happening in Russia because of the potential for escalation on a major scale and possibly even nuclear weapons. And you talk about somebody who is incoherent. Well, somebody who is coherent is the Russian side, and their patience seems to be coming to an end, as now that they gave a warning to Rubio himself and to all public statements that everybody, all foreigners, need to get out of Kiev because something big is coming systematically, implying this is not just a strike that's coming, but something more fundamental that may be coming, possibly as early as tonight. People have been told to get out of there. And what do you make, first of all, of that claim here? And of course, this all goes to the allegedly the Ukrainian side hit a school that killed a bunch of kids in the Luhansk, in the Russian-controlled part of that oblast there. And Russia's there. That's it. You guys, NATO's been giving you guys cover air support or letting you use the air corridors to attack into Russia. Now then you're giving them help that's striking our people in the eastern part of Ukraine, and what we call Ukraine. And now then they say, that's it. We're going to do something. Where do you think we are on that, and what do you think Russia may do?
Well, let's look at the difference between the American electorate and the Russian population. If President Trump were to announce tomorrow, I'm announcing national mobilization. We are re-implementing the draft. And all of this is to win decisively against Iran, which, of course, is the sort of implication that you had from Petraeus earlier. What would happen in the United States? What do you think, Dan?
Well, I mean, I think people would be up in arms. They'd be just going crazy. They don't want to go fight a war against somebody else.
Of course, they'd say, well, what the hell are we doing? This is insane, you know? Who cares what happens in the Persian Gulf? This is the United States. What are we doing here? What are you doing to fix my problems? My problems, buying gas, buying food, and so forth and so on. Absolutely. But in Russia, it's different. The Russian population and its government are far closer together, far more aligned than people in the United States and the Western world understand. The Russian people are fed up. They've had enough. They want this to end. And if Vladimir Putin said, I have resisted this, I have opposed this, but I see no alternative. I am mobilizing Russia for war to end the war with Ukraine. That would be welcomed in Russia. People would rather go at it and get it over with than live with this nonsense anymore. And so you have a very different set of circumstances. We don't get it. So when Lavrov says what he does, or Putin says what he does, or even Karaganov, and I'm not endorsing his comments on nuclear weapons, and I don't think that's something the Russians want to do. But when they listen to that, the average Russian says, yes, what are we putting up with this for? Let's get it over with. Let's march in there and destroy these people. They're bad. They're evil. There's no alternative to it. So look at those two pictures. And the U.S. side is not going to do what Petraeus wants to do. Just as we never really surged in Afghanistan. You remember that. There was this talk about sending 80 to 100,000 troops. And then somebody said, well, we got down to what, 38,000 or 40,000. But in reality, what happened? Not much. We talked for years about the pivot to China. And the pivot to China was always briefed in private as enormously expensive because you'd have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars for new facilities, new infrastructure all over Asia in order to support operations against the Chinese. So what really happened in Asia with the war against China? Not much. Now let's talk about reality. Our economy is fragile. The financial system is on the verge of falling apart. Inflation is up. Interest rates are rising. The bond market could easily collapse. What are we going to do? The answer is not much. So let's be honest and stop bluffing. Bluffs are dangerous because the Russians are not bluffing.
And you know, that worries me, I got to say, Doug, because let me just kind of pop this here. There's some new information here. It's out that Moscow claims that some mines were found on a tanker. It was arriving from Belgium. 7 kilograms of explosives each were found attached to the vessel's underwater hull, which could have, I don't know if it's, it could have been a false flag. I don't know for sure what it could have been, but it could have been something that, that blew up in a Russian port. What do you make of this?
What I make of it is as follows. President Trump has failed miserably to provide the leadership to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that he, as the President of the United States, is obligated to provide. All he's done is bully and attack and abuse and offend people in the hopes of driving them to spend more on national defense. Well, if you call that leadership, that's fine. I don't see that as evidence for real leadership. And the leadership he needs to provide right now is to end the nonsense in Ukraine. This was always the first thing he needed to do, because this war in Ukraine has always been dangerous, because there was never any guarantee that it would not suddenly explode and widen. That's what everyone worried about from the beginning, with good reason, anyone with a brain. The fact that it hasn't doesn't mean it won't. That's the point. And if you're a Russian right now, and you look at what the Baltic states have done to facilitate and support these attacks inside Russia, when you look at Poland and what the Poles have done, the Germans, the Czechs, the Scandinavians, the British, all of these states in one way or another have contributed components, intelligence, equipment, and technology. You conclude we've got to do something. And something is usually very bad. And in this case, it could be catastrophic. President Trump needs to step up and say it's over. Very easy. You don't send 5,000 more troops to Poland when the Germans are telling you to get out. You don't send 5,000 more troops to Poland when you're trying to bring a stupid, self-defeating, destructive war in Ukraine to an end. He has got to wake up. He's got to be the leader he wants to be and says he is, but he's not. That means ending the war in Ukraine the only way it could ever end, and that is by pulling the plug 100% on our side. Get out. And then encourage and be willing to host whatever conferences may be necessary so that at least the countries that border Russia and Ukraine have a say in what the outcome looks like, provided that state is neutral, not a member of NATO, and presents no threat to Russia. Those things can be done. He can do that. He never has. He's failed. And as far as the Persian Gulf is concerned, since we're not going to invade Iran to ensure that Iran becomes whatever Israel wants it to be, it's time to come to Jesus, not Netanyahu, and end the war.
Indeed. There's one last thing I'd like to touch. I don't know if you have enough time. I know we're near the end of the normal time. Do you have a few more minutes?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Real quick, because I think it's something that's important. In terms of the nature of the war in the European side here, it's a little bit different. There's a lot of information out here recently that Ukraine has continued to advance in its drone capability. In fact, they're compensating for the lack of troops by having a lot more drones, a lot of different categories of drones. Their technology has genuinely advanced and are striking deeper inside of Russia. But when you look at the Russian side of this, this is released by the Russian MOD. They have some numbers here that don't fit what most people think. And they're saying that 55% of the casualties inflicted on the Ukraine side still come from artillery and rockets, 32% by air power, and only 8% by UAVs and first-person view drones, et cetera, which surprised me because I had heard, and most people have claimed, that it's reversed. It's actually a lot higher percentage with that in modern warfare. What do you make of these numbers, or are they even accurate?
No, I think they're pretty accurate. And, you know, we tend to dismiss whatever the Russians say out of hand, but I think it's a serious mistake. We would do well to look at those percentages. Artillery, as you know, Dan, has always been the big killer on the battlefield. In 1945, when we held the post-war conference for the army in Bad Tölz in Bavaria, George Patton walked into the conference. Everyone was seated there. Almost all of the generals were present. There were still a couple coming in. And they started proceedings, and Patton stood up and said, "Well, men, we all know who won this war, the artillery." Now stop and think about that for a minute, the artillery. I must have interviewed 1,000 German veterans in my time. And when they talked about the United States Army, they had many things to say, not all of which were very complimentary, but one thing they all said repeatedly was the American artillery was devastating, accurate, and responsive. That's also true right now for the Russians. And in addition to that, we now have something called air power. And air power had a huge impact on the Second World War, but it wasn't as decisive as the artillery because it wasn't as accurate. Today, that's changed. We can bomb and exploit missile power with enormous precision and accuracy. So when you look at those first two percentages, it makes infinite sense. Now, why is everybody talking about FPVs and unmanned systems and loitering munitions? Well, there are several agendas at work here. And I think people always see what they want to see as opposed to what is there. In the last quarter, I think the Russians reported the loss of 35 tanks. Now, that doesn't mean the tanks were totally destroyed. This means that those tanks were put out of action. 35. The Russians have over 1,000 right now on the ground in Ukraine and Belarusia. So what are we saying? That these unmanned systems, these loitering munitions, are now the decisive weapon in the war? No, they're not. Are they useful? Absolutely. But there are countermeasures in the form of electronic warfare and in the form of capturing radar signatures and attacking with multiple kinds of weapons with different kinds of munitions that are very, very effective. Even something as simplistic as a shotgun can be effective against these FPVs. Now, some of these FPVs have also used fiber optic threads that guide these things. That means someone guides them to the target. The problem with that is it's not very difficult to figure out once you see this drone coming and it has a fiber optic thread behind it, where it came from. And guess what is used to destroy the launch site? Artillery. In other words, when you figure out where the drone operator is, when you figure out where the drones were launched from, you hit it with artillery. And the artillery is incredibly accurate. So those numbers really aren't surprising. And the final thing is you have a very unhealthy and dangerous trend, I would say, right now in the U.S. Armed Forces. And that is that we want to go backwards. We want to go back with Dave Petraeus into 1942 with combined arms warfare. We want to go backwards with the generals to masses and masses of light infantry. You know, once I talked to a veteran of the Second World War, and he was watching us on Reforger, and he said, "This isn't real war." I said, "Well, why isn't it?" He said, "Well, I see all these tanks and all this artillery, but where are the thousands of infantrymen walking along the roads?" Well, that was a reasonable assumption on his part based on his experience. But the problem right now is that individual infantryman is more prone to destruction, more easily killed, more easily maimed than ever in history. And one of the reasons the Russians have taken so far few casualties is, first of all, they dig in when they can and for whatever reason, and they do it very effectively, but they also are in armored vehicles. And these armored vehicles are now protected. They're protected either within the vehicle itself by various kinds of countermeasures, but more important, they're operating within an integrated air and missile defense network. So the ground force does have protection. This is something that we're ignoring, and we're conjuring up these images of Superman with the jetpack and the laser weapon, who is bebopping around the battlefield and winning the battle. You know, I mean, this kind of craziness was popular in the 30s. We had rocket ships then and laser guns and so forth. And then we've had various physicists at different points of time say, we're on the verge of these ray guns. We're going to have them next week, next year, next month. It hasn't happened. A lot of this is not going to happen for a long time, if ever. And again, everyone misses the countermeasure. For every measure, there's a countermeasure. There is no silver bullet weapon out there right now. And finally, and this is going to surprise people, we often talk about the use of the atom bomb against the Japanese. we credit that with bringing the war to the end. There's a lot of debate about that, because the Soviet offensive in Manchuria in August of 1945 was really what scared the hell out of the Japanese, because they were afraid the Russians would cross, the Soviets would cross, and that would be the end of Japan as they knew it. But we still went in on the ground in Japan. In other words, we didn't drop a bomb, declare victory, and walk away. The Russians can't do that. We can't do that. We need to come to terms with that. And if we're not willing to commit ground forces, then why the hell are we doing it?
Yeah, and I think it's whether you're talking about the Iran war or the war against Russia and Ukraine, we don't want to, we just want it to be easy. We just want to have our preference just turn into reality, even if it isn't. And that's one of the things I think is going to lead to our ultimate defeat and possibly demise as a superpower if we keep going down those dark paths. Well, listen, Doug, we're very grateful for you to coming on today and highlighting these things, because we just don't get this kind of information from very many other people. It's one of the reasons I always highlight that you're a highly decorated combat veteran, because you've been on the tip of the spear and you know what you're talking about here. You've lived it, and you have always been foreseeing through your books and stuff that you've written as far back as 1997 about the future of warfare. So it's something we should all take very seriously, and we thank you today for bringing it to light. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys, too. And just to let you know, oh, Lord, I had missed that. Yeah, that's gunboat diplomacy. Is that something? Where's that coming from, Gary? I just now looked down there.
Well, that's
this is Doug's Substack. Okay, great. Awesome.
Yeah, I think people would enjoy reading it. It's called Epitaph for Donald Trump's Gunboat Diplomacy. And I think that's where we are, sadly. But I guess on the other hand, sometimes you have to fail to figure out what's right, what works, what doesn't, and perhaps that will be a corrective to some of our other problems. Who knows?
Man, we can just hope that the cost doesn't come too high to learn those lessons. That's what we'll have to do. Also, to let you guys know, we have a couple of other really hot guests today. First of all, we're going to have Professor Mirandi, who's going to give us the no-kidding look. Here's what the Iranian side is saying. Forget about what is being characterized in a lot of the Western media. We're going to hear straight from the source in Tehran live this afternoon at 1 p.m. from Professor Mirandi about where they are. And then at 2 p.m., we're going to have Scott Ritter, and he's going to go into more detail about what is going on in Russia and what may be coming next, and is the war going to expand? He's going to be talking to us later then today at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much, folks, and we'll see you on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.